You're listening to the Humans of DevOps podcast, a podcast focused on advancing the humans of DevOps through skills, knowledge, ideas, and learning, or the SKIL framework.
People love that, and they will just open the doors. I know I would. Like, if someone knocks on my door, it's like, hey, I'm excited to do this thing. Where can I do more Python or system administration? Like, it doesn't matter. It's like, dude, you're hired. Like, what? Can I sign you right away?
Hey everyone, it's Jason Baum, Director of Member Experience at DevOps Institute, and this is the Humans of DevOps podcast. Welcome back. Hope you had another great week. I'm super excited this I'm excited every week. I say that every week, but I am super excited this week, especially because if you are a frequent listener to this podcast, you know I'm a pretty avid sports fan, and I usually go on some sort of sports rant that I eventually have to tie back into the program and then apologize to our producer. But today, I finally get to chat about sports in an official capacity. So the Olympics are here again. I'm sure you know that already. So we thought it would be interesting to bring on a former Olympian. Plus, this Olympian happens to be a cloud advocate at Microsoft. So my guest today is Alfredo Deza. He's a passionate software engineer, avid open source developer, author, photographer, and a former Olympic athlete. He has given several lectures across the world about open source software, personal development, and professional sports. He's rebuilt company infrastructure, designed shared storage, and replaced complex build systems, always in search of efficient and resilient environments. With a strong belief in testing and documentation, he continues to drive robust development practices wherever he is. So, Alfredo, thank you so much for coming on the podcast and agreeing to talk sports with me and a little bit about DevOps and tech.
Absolutely. Thank you. Thank you so much, Jason, for having me. Super happy to be here and talk about everything. Yeah, sure, including sports.
Awesome. Well, you're ready to get human?
Yeah.
All right, let's do it. So tell us first, I guess we should start. We teased, you're an Olympic athlete. So tell us a little bit, what was your sport? What was that experience like? And, which country did you represent?
Yeah. So I was born in Peru and I lived there until I was 26, almost 26. Yeah, no, 26. And, you reminded me about this one time where there was this reporter and says like, oh, so how many months did you have to train for the Olympics? Not that you asked that question, but this person asked me that. And it's like this reporter, like, that's such a weird thing. So I said like, well, I did that for like 15 years. So it's like, I didn't train for a few months. That's, you don't get to, I mean, I don't know if anyone has gone to Olympic Games just by working out like for a few months.
So you mean if I train for 6 months, I can't too go to the Olympics?
I don't think so. That, I mean, hats off to you if you do that, but you manage to accomplish that. That's intense, but I don't think it works that way. There's a lot of competition.
I don't know. I watched the show Cheer and my back hurts. So I don't know if I'm going to be good for that, but
yeah. No, it does take a lot of effort, and it took me years. It took me a good chunk of my life for a while. And I did the high jump. I jumped 2 meters and 27 centimeters, and that's around 7 feet 4 inches ish, something around that. And I did it for years. My dad also went to Olympic Games. He went to Mexico City. I think that was 1968. I really liked sports ever since I was a kid. And when I was around 11 years old, I told my dad that I really wanted to like get serious into training and working out, because there's different ways to train, prepare yourself and work out. You could say, well, you know, I'm a, I don't know, like I like tennis, or I do soccer or do swimming. It's like, oh, how many times a week? Oh, twice a week or three times a week. And, but when you're really into it, it just never ends. It never stops, and multiple times a day. And when I was in school, I would have to just stop for school. But otherwise, when I got out of high school, it was between 12 times a week, all the way to like close to 18 times a week of workouts. So most days, twice a day, in the morning and the afternoon.
And how long were the workouts?
They were usually close to 2 hours, depending on the type of workout. On the off season, they were more lengthy, and when the competitions were close by, they were shorter. But I would say on the shorter end, maybe like an hour and 20 minutes, and up to 2 hours.
I mean, it's a full-time job of working out.
It is. And it doesn't end with when the workout ends, because then the workout ends and then you have to think about recovery. So you have to, I would carry my ice packs everywhere and my bandages. So just, you know, put the ice packs in my legs while I was driving back home, and then taking a nap. And I mean, you might think like, oh, this guy is taking a nap. And then I would go to the sauna and do some massage sessions. And then someone could say, like, oh, that's fantastic. That's great. No, it's not great, because you're very tired all day long, every day. And you really want to just take a break, and you just can't. You can't. You have to keep going.
And if you don't do that recovery, you don't move the next day. So yeah. Did you ever do those like hyperbolic chambers?
I actually did. But you know what? Now thinking about them, they really scare me. You know, kind of like when you think about a certain situation, it's like, ooh, that's, you kind of, you get into that, mentally into that situation, and it just gets really scary. That's how I feel about those doing that. But I don't know. Like, it was a thing back in the, I mean, but probably still a thing, but I did them in the early 2000s. And there were just a couple of places that they would do that in Peru. And I did them, but I can't really tell if it did anything. Maybe it did. I mean, we were measuring. There wasn't not a way of accurately measuring the impact.
Yeah, I feel like that cupping, like there's all the different methods of recovery, and it seems to change. But like, I mean, that's the amount of work that you have to put in to be an Olympic athlete, an athlete alone, let alone an Olympic athlete, which is like taking it the next degree up. Obviously, it's intense. So, how did you do in the Olympics?
The Olympics was pretty rough for me. I didn't do well at all. You know, I think it's interesting, outside of Peru. I don't live in Peru. I haven't been living in Peru for the past 15 years. I live in the US now. Outside of Peru, I would say it's interesting how having been to the Olympic Games is seen as a huge accomplishment and something worth celebrating. I wouldn't say so much in Peru. The reaction is like, you know, probably like not, you know, maybe it's like, oh, that's great, you went to the Olympic Games. Not something worth celebrating that much, I would say. But in Peru, when I was 18 years old, and I think this is kind of like what I was more known or recognized back in Peru. In 1998, I was 18 years old, and it was the World Junior Championships for track and field, and I won. I became the first ever world champion in track and field for Peru. And that was a big deal. That was a very big deal. And that was in the newspapers and TV, and like I had interviews all the time, and that was huge. And you know, you mentioned these things, but I think that the Olympic Games, you know, trying to Like I tried to keep up that momentum, and that was in 1998. The Olympic Games that I went to was in 2004. So it took me a while to get there and to qualify. You have to jump a certain height. And it was very hard. I would say that the usual mentality of an athlete or a high performance athlete is to, you're going there and you're not just having a vacation time or having a blast. I mean, yeah, sure, it's wonderful and it's a great environment and full of athletes and everybody's there to compete. It's a special moment. But not doing well was devastating to me. Mm-hmm. I was sponsored. I guess you could consider me a professional athlete, and I was a professional athlete. There, I had a sponsor, and this sponsor decided to drop me while I was at the Olympic Games, not because of my performance, but because they were going bankrupt and they were not doing well. And wow. So the thing is that that kind of like marked the end of my career, at least mentally. I just could not stand this. I'm like not doing well. This is horrible. I can't keep doing this. I'm 20, almost 26 years old, and this is very hard. So I remember after competing and doing horrendous at the Olympic Games, but horrendous by my standards, you know.
You were
at the Olympic Games, yes, but you know, you're working yourself to like for 15 years to get to some place. You're expecting to do well, but it's really hard. It is really, really hard. You're trying to accomplish the best ever performance in your life. You're not going to nail it. It's really difficult. Like when you see an athlete just, that's why like usually world records don't necessarily happen at the Olympic Games. Sometimes they do, but not all of the time. And usually records at the Olympic Games are not, are lesser than the real world records because, you know, world records are like easier to kind of like, I think I can nail it between these two or three events within these two or three weeks. Maybe I can hit it there, and then you do, and then that's great. But the Olympic Games is like, have seen in 4 years, and you have this one time, and then that's it.
Oh yeah, I mean, athletes are all programmed the same. I feel like you're there to win. Like, you know, no one gets into athletics to not win. So totally get how anything less than that is deemed to yourself as a failure. But in perspective, how many people were competing in high jump at that Olympic game?
I think we were, you're asking all the right questions. I think there were 15, I think. So I was probably like 13th or 12th or something like that.
So 12th 13th or 13th, maybe. But out of the entire world of all the athletes. That's a pretty big accomplishment. So yeah, that's why it's when you're in it, I totally get it. But at the same time, unless you're the top three in the world, you're coming home a failure, right? Honestly, I bet for some athletes, it must be an absolute it must be devastating to not even get silver or gold.
Yeah. You know, I felt like I failed my country. I failed. Like my country doesn't owe me anything. I don't owe anything to anyone. Like, it wasn't like they gave me a huge house and five cars to just I mean, it wasn't like that, you know. But I did.
Wouldn't that
feel
be nice?
Like, yeah, it would have. Yeah. I felt like I failed my country. I felt like to me it was a wonderful way to give happiness and hope and just a general good feeling to people, specifically in Peru. I think Peru, as it happens with much of Latin America, is a country that continues to fight social and political issues and a lot of corruption. And I think that whenever there's a sports event and a fellow countryman is they're doing great, it's just fantastic, you know, to provide happiness to others in such a nice and pure way, I would say.
You know, it's also interesting, and I feel like this is kind of bringing it back to tech, to work, to, you know, to our work life, is the amount of effort and time and everything that you put into your sport, whether it be your sport, your craft, your job. Even though you might be putting in a ton of effort, a ton of work, sometimes the results aren't there, and it's not anything that you didn't do. I mean, you were training for 40 whatever hours a week, you're doing all the recovery, you do everything right, you're eating right, and you spent 16 years 50 whatever what, right 15 16 years
yeah,
doing it
like that. Yep.
Yeah, so, and I mean, gosh, I mean, you could think about anything that you do, and you're not always going to win, and that is tough for competitive. I'm a competitive person, I played sports, you know, I totally have that mindset, and so, you know, but everybody fails, and that's at some point. And then you have your wins, and you definitely, and the losses mean more, because the losses you feel because you still put in the effort. And for some reason, when you don't have that outcome that you desired, God, that one stings, because it's like, well, I still did it all. And it feels like,
yep,
not a waste. It shouldn't feel that way. But in the moment, it hurts.
Yeah, I would say professionally in a corporate environment or at regular work, your regular 9-to-5, I would say, to me, it feels a little bit different. The other day, I heard this thing that I really liked, that is, there's no failure. We're not failing. We're either learning or we're winning. What are we going to do today? Well, I learned, like, yes, you know, like in, I think it's hard to apply that to professional sports, like, or if you're doing something like track and field or swimming or whatever it is, because, you know, like, yeah, you fail, like, sure, you could try, but it's really hard. What I would do when I was an athlete, it would be like, okay, next season, I'm going to fix here. I'm going to train better and more. And but there's so much that you can do, you know, like not everybody can run, under 10 seconds in the 100 meter dash. I mean, it's just like, it might not be physically possible for you to accomplish that. So let's set some reality here. But if we're talking about, you know, performing well at work and being a good coworker, you know, I think, I don't want to say it's easier, but I think there's more room here for doing well and not necessarily have devastating failures. So I think that phrase of, you know, there's we're not failing, we're either learning or winning, I think it's just great, because every time that I've messed up at work, and I've messed up a bunch of times, it's been like, ooh, a learning moment. I know that stings, and I know I'm gonna do it better. And I try to put all those stories in every book that I've written. Some people don't like the stories. It's like, oh, why are you talking about a story that happened? Like, nobody cares about, like, there was a comment, someone made these comments, like, nobody cares about your horrible boss 10 years ago, Alfredo. Like, tell us more about login systems and get to the point. But, you know, to me, it's like, hey, you want to talk to me? You want me to tell you something useful? I'm going to do that, but I'm going to tell you a story. I mean, if you want to read something super technical, like, and not have any context about it, go read a manual. It doesn't matter.
Go see the PowerPoint presentation.
Yes. Go into the terminal, run the man page command, mm-hmm. and go read a manual. There's no story there. It's just straight to the facts. But that's not, you know, what I try to do is, let me tell you a story why I think logging is a good idea, because let me show you what happened when there was no logging or logging was impossible and we tried to solve a problem. And again, learning moment.
Yeah. So I think anybody could read a recipe. Not everyone could be a chef.
Yes.
Yeah. Today's episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast is sponsored by Collide. Collide is an endpoint security solution that sends your employees important and timely security recommendations for their Linux, Mac, and Windows devices right inside Slack. Collide is perfect for organizations that care deeply about compliance and security, but don't want to get there by locking down devices to the point where they become unusable. Instead of frustrating your employees, Collide educates them about security and device management while directing them to fix important problems. You can try Collide with all its features on an unlimited number of devices free for 14 days. No credit card required. Visit collide.com/HODP to sign up today. That's Collide, KOLIDE.com/HODP. Enter your email when prompted to receive your free Collide gift bundle after trial activation. So that's a great transition then. You know, the yearning to learn that you have. How does one go from being a lifelong professional athlete? That is your focus. It has to be, I mean, all the time.
Yep.
To becoming a software engineer and an author.
Yeah, you know, it wasn't an easy transition. It was very hard. First off, like, I decided to leave my country. And both my parents said, this is a horrible idea.
Some great motivation.
Yeah.
Encouragement.
I mean, they were right. They were right because I didn't go to college. I mean, I went to college for like a few months and then I said, like, I can't do this. This is not really for me. I wasn't finding myself interested in the stuff that was going on at college. So I just dropped out after a few months. So I would consider that like as I didn't go to college, or I guess technically a dropout. So didn't go to college, didn't have any other formal education into any career skill whatsoever. No experience working at, like I didn't perform any work stuff. So it was mostly I'm an athlete and that's what I do for a living. And no experience doing anything other than professional sports. So when I said, well, I'm moving to the US, it was more of like, whoa, wait a second, you're gonna and what are you gonna do in the like in the US? Like, that sounds you're going to lose your stability. At least here in Peru, doors may open up for you because people know you, people have heard your name and they know who you are, and you know, worst comes to worst, like they at least know your name, and you're going to go to the US where nobody knows you. But to me, it felt sort of liberating because I could reinvent myself. I could be someone completely different. And for the longest time, I wouldn't put any of my track and field accomplishments anywhere in any of my profiles. I wouldn't. It would drive my dad crazy. He would be like very upset that I wouldn't do that, because it's like, that's insane. Like, you're doing a disservice to yourself. This is not very good for a good strategy for you, especially because you're starting from scratch. And I agree with that, but I wouldn't feel comfortable because, and even today, to me, it feels kind of like, I don't want to be perceived as someone that is a show off, you know, like, and thank you for asking me this question, because I think if anyone listening, wants to rescue something that is very good, very positive, very useful from this interview, it's that it's not necessarily the Olympics. It's not necessarily that I was the first ever world champion for Peru, but I did this transition, which was extremely hard. And I came to the US. I had just recently married. Again, talk about things that my parents thought were not excellent ideas, because, you know, how are you going to support your new family if you're not working? It's like, and so we came to the US, and it was extremely hard. I started being a personal trainer, in a kind of like a volunteer coach, trying to teach people to high jump and trying to teach people how to work out properly. I was interested in technology, but I didn't exactly knew what to do, where to go. At that time, YouTube perhaps didn't exist, or if it existed, like it wasn't as useful as it is today. So I would go into a local bookstore and read technology books. And it's like, oh, and so I started writing. I wanted to have a blog, and I learned about Linux, started getting really interested into Linux. And so I wanted to learn more and more and more about that, and started becoming sort of proficient in doing things in Linux, and found myself having the opportunity to work for a company that needed a system administrator, but just for a few hours. And so that meant that, oh, wow, like this is great, because I'm going to be able to just prove myself that I can learn. And I was just so hungry to prove myself, to do this thing, to learn, to keep doing things. And it was like, it depends. Sometimes, you know, things are hard. Work is hard, but definitely in those early years, I was super motivated and very eager to learn. And there were a few people that noticed, and where they caused tremendous impact in my career. And I owe them a lot.
Who were those people?
One of these guys, he's an Argentinian. He's a wonderful human being. He was the chief technologist for this large product that they were creating, a virtual world. He's a Java specialist. He's working from Argentina in 2000. Like, he's a remote person working for an office here in Atlanta, and he's in Argentina. And he says, "Hey, Alfredo, like, you know, if I've tried, like, we're doing this monitoring of the whole system. It's three databases here, four web servers over there. And then we have and application servers. I think there were like another two or three." So it was like a very large virtual world thing in Java. And they wanted some scripting to be done to kind of like put everything in maintenance mode. And there was a specific order that you need to shut down the application. And so the web servers would change the HTML and shows like, hey, we're, you know, kind of like a message saying, hey, we're doing some maintenance work, and the databases, we need to follow them. And so it's a special order, and you need to do the thing. And he wanted me to script that. And I've never in my life programmed before. And so he's like, oh, you're going to do it. You know, it's fine. And his name is Carlos Col. And Carlos said, you're going to do this. But I said, hey, Carlos, but like, I don't know how to program. It's like, not a problem. I'm very busy, but every day, 15 minutes, I'll give you 15 minutes early in the morning. You come in early and I'll answer any questions. I'll tell you where to read and what to look for. And then we'll rinse and repeat every day. And then you'll make some progress and we'll get this done. And I said, okay, all right, let's do this. And I started doing that. And I felt like horrible. It's kind of like, you know, I don't want to sound like, you know, I know languages. I know Spanish is my so Spanish and Portuguese kind of similar, but not Russian or not Chinese. So learning how to program is kind of like that. Like, if I know Spanish, it doesn't necessarily mean I know how to, you know, speak Chinese or read Chinese. It would be, and so it's like someone dropped me in Beijing and I have to like figure it out, how to survive. And I was like, I don't know anything. This is, and so I started having nightmares. I wasn't sleeping because I felt like a lot of responsibility. I need to like get this thing going. And one day I said, okay, that's it. I'm going to tell this guy. I told my wife, I'm going to tell this guy, I can't do it anymore. I quit. Like, he has to find someone else. And he said, okay. You know, like I went there, I talked to him. It's like, yes, Alfredo, what's going on? It's like, that's it. No more. I can't program. I don't know how to do this. You're asking me to do all of these things. This seems very important and I'm not making any progress. So I quit. And he said, wait, what is it that you're not understanding? Well, I don't know what this thing is. I don't know what that thing, but that thing does. I'm very confused. It's like, oh, one second. So that thing that you don't understand, you need to read this thing. And this sort of thing works like this. Okay. Yes. Okay. Okay. Do you get it now? Yes. Okay. See you tomorrow. And he didn't let me quit. He didn't let me quit. He. So I was like, this guy, you seriously? And we managed to do it. Like I completed the whole thing and I learned how to program just fantastic. I mean, just super grateful. I think in the Python for DevOps book that I wrote for O'Reilly, I think it was 2019. I think we finished that. I actually just thank him because he was essential for me, critical in my career to get me going.
That's awesome. Wow. You don't every day have someone who's refuses to quit on you, even when you're ready to quit yourself.
Yeah.
But refuses to quit on you. That's pretty amazing. Probably saw in you what you just described that you wish you could have in someone.
But
you probably ticked those boxes, I'm assuming, for him. All right. Well, I mean, this has been absolutely amazing getting to meet you, talk about your career, your life. I mean, you have outside of the box, I would say, is the best way to describe your path that you went on. Definitely not the standard, but my gosh, you must have learned so much that we haven't even touched on. I think we scratched the surface. So I think people will have to get your books.
You know, the books, people think it's like, oh, but writing books is very good. Like, yeah, it's a lot of work. Like if you ever run a marathon, it's like running a marathon and it never ends. And you're like, oh man, like this is pretty rough. But, you know, I'm just genuinely happy to be here and to kind of like convey the message of, you know, working hard and doing a lot of effort. And if that ends up, you know, someone saying, well, let me just search this dude around. Maybe he's writing interesting books about, you know, DevOps or Python or, you know, the last book was machine learning operations, which is kind of like related to DevOps for machine learning. I mean, that's great. But, you know, if they don't, that's also good. Like I'm here to just share the stories and in all those books full of stories. So if you like the stories here, then go find the books.
I was going to say, I want to hear more stories. You're definitely going to have to come back, but I do have a final question for you.
Yes.
So we always ask our guests one final question. We usually like them to dig deep a little, think,
okay.
It's usually somewhat personal. This one's I think relevant. So if DevOps was an Olympic event, which sport or event would it be?
You know what? I think more than a sport, I would say being a coach. Hmm. I think that's what I would say. Not necessarily like a specific event. A coach has to have like lots of experience, has to know like what to apply to their athletes, where do they excel, what is the right environment, and continuously plan, measure, and operate on this bigger plan of doing things and events and competitions and try to keep improving things. So I would say a coach sounds more like a DevOps engineer.
I think that's a great answer. I think that's wonderful. All right. Well, I mean, Alfredo, I can't thank you enough for coming on and sharing some of those stories. You're going to have to come back because I have a ton more. So maybe when it's the Summer Olympics, you'll come back and talk to us again and share even more.
Sure. That sounds great, Jason. I appreciate a ton being here. Anytime I can come back anytime. Happy to keep talking more about these things and again, just emphasizing it's not about for me about, you know, having done well in sports, but you know, the message is like, hey, just keep grinding, keep doing excellent work, be useful, be motivated, show genuine enthusiasm about things. And I think especially here in the US, I think people love that and they will just open the doors. I know I would. Like if someone knocks on my door and is like, hey, I'm excited to do this thing, where can I do more Python or system administration? Like it doesn't matter. It's like, dude, you're hired. Like what the, just can I sign you right away? And before you know, before we go, like let me tell you these tiny short story.
Sure.
I was helping out. They told us like, hey, you need to get some time aside to help this person. She's in Latin America. She's wants someone to review her resume, and it's in Spanish. Can you help her out? And so I said, like, okay, that's fine. And in her resume, she said, I'm very motivated and I want to learn new things. And I asked him, like, well, can you explain to me a little bit more what you're doing? Are you going to college? Yes, I'm studying and I'm doing this. Okay, and what else? How's your English? Oh, my English is, I'm going twice a week to an English institute and learning English. Oh, okay, that's great. And how's your programming? Oh, well, I'm taking twice a week classes to do learn Python. Oh, okay, so, but you're going to college as well. Yeah. And this resume is for what are you trying to do? Well, I'm doing part-time working at this company that is doing automation on email systems. It's just like, whoa, hold on 1 second. So you're going to college, you're learning English, you're learning how to code in Python, and you're working part-time in a company. I mean, that's incredible. Don't say that you're trying to, you know, like to learn new things. Just, you have to blow it out of the water and say, hey, look at all of these things that I'm doing. And I'm in a third world country where things are already difficult. And look what I'm already trying to do. It's like, this is insane. I would hire you yesterday if it was up to me. This is incredible. And I think that's the type of people that we need. And if you're one of those, well, that's great. I'm pretty sure things are just going to work very well for you.
That's awesome. That's awesome. Yeah, we all need our own personal hype person behind us, I think, sometimes.
Yeah, like, absolutely. You
know, our own Flavor Flav. Awesome. Thanks so much, Alfredo. Really appreciate it. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. I'm going to end this episode the same way I always do, encouraging you to become a member of DevOps Institute to get access to even more great resources just like this one. Until next time, stay safe, stay healthy, and most of all, stay human. Live long and prosper.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Humans of DevOps podcast. Don't forget to join our global community to get access to even more great resources like this. Until next time, remember, you are part of something bigger than yourself. You belong.